From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When people talk about how divided we are as a country these days, they sometimes make it sound as if this is a recent phenomenon, or at least that it's particularly bad lately. But the writer Colin Woodard says, actually, we've always been divided as a country. In fact, it's more a surprise that we've ever been able to agree on anything. The people who settled North America were from very different places, of course, and Woodard says these centuries-old cultures are still with us today. He says there's never been just one America. There are several. 11, in fact. 11 regional nations that represent different values and beliefs and practices. Woodard is joining us today to break down some of these nations within a nation to help us understand not only where we came from, but where we seem to be going. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. How many of you joked about wanting to move when Donald Trump was elected president? Wanted to find some enclave of like-minded people? Or maybe you heard from friends and family members in states that weren't so red. Maybe they made these offhanded comments about wanting to secede from the U.S. Well, that sentiment is as old as this country. In fact, the journalist and historian Colin Woodard says even though they came together to fight a war for independence, nearly all of the original American colonies had moments when they seriously considered trying to get back on their own. And the reason is simple. These are very different places with very different cultures that are hundreds and hundreds of years old. In a book he wrote a few years ago, Woodard explains that some of these cultures are based on individualism, some on utopian social reform, some are bound to one ethnic identity, some are more pluralistic. Woodard says there isn't and has never been one America, but rather several Americas. And that's what we're talking about today, those several Americas. Turns out there are 11 of these nations. That's what Woodard calls them. Not regions, not states. Nations. In fact, he says, to understand all of this, you have to forget about a conventional map with boundaries. Forget about the regions you hear about in election years, like the Northeast, the Midwest, the South. Woodard's book is American Nations, and he's joining us today to talk about it. He's a journalist, an historian, a reporter for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. He's written 5 books, including American Character and the Republic of Pirates. He recently wrote an article, we should say, about Envision Utah and growth along the Wasatch Front for Politico's series What Works. He's joining us today from a studio in Portland, Maine. And Colin Woodard, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So there's this theme in American life that you write about, one that we keep coming back to time and time again, and that is this idea that Americans are divided because we've strayed from a core principle, and that this country in its purest form is built around one common theme, one sense of identity and unity. But you say that's a fallacy, and in fact, this idea is kind of the heart of your books. Start there, this myth that we believe about ourselves.
Well, sure. I mean, when you go back in history, you know, a lot of people try to go back to the founding fathers and that period when the Constitution was being written and see that as sort of the beginnings of the country's history. But the real founders of the country were in the 1600s and early 1700s. You know, the founding generation were the great-grandchildren and great-great-great-grandchildren mm-hmm. of these original founders from the colonial period. And those people had very little in common in terms of political goals and fundamental values and ideas about what the good life would share, for the simple reason that our continent, our indeed what became the United States, was settled as a series of separate and unrelated colonial projects. I mean, you had English colonies on the on the eastern shores of the continent that were populated from people of very different parts of the British Isles with entirely different ethnography, dominant religious ideas, political goals, the structure of society, ideas about what, you know, the good life and what sort of society they should be building. Plus you had areas settled by the Dutch and the French and the Spanish where the original colonization was entirely different. And each of these areas, each of these separate colonial clusters, say Puritan New England or the manorial, you know, semi-feudal culture of the Chesapeake region, each of these places settled a mutually exclusive strip of the continent in different areas. Much of the continent was settled by one or another of settlement streams, each of which began with one of these colonial clusters. They tended to avoid each other in their patterns as they head westward, and that's had very deep implications ever since. It's created these fissures and fault lines and separate regional cultures, stateless nations really, where the settlement streams brought with them institutions, ideas encoded into constitutions, into the basic frameworks of government, into the values of the people that became sort of the de facto culture, as it were, mm-hmm. that other people encountered when they came to those areas. We're a federation, remember, not a nation, and there's a reason for that tied back to this fractured colonial history.
We did come together, of course, the colonies did anyway, to fight and win the revolution, create this joint government. But you talk about how it seems like we've always been unsettled together. Like all of the original colonies, or most of them anyway, wanted out at one point or another in those first decades. And there have always been, you know, people sort of laugh at the idea of Rick Perry, former governor of Texas, talking about wanting Texas to secede. But people have only half joked about that, it seems like, all throughout our history.
Yeah, in the 80 years after the Battle of Yorktown that ended the American Revolution, virtually all of the regional cultures around at that time considered seceding at one point or another. You know, the New England colonies were horrified by the War of 1812 and were, you know, conspiring, considering leaving the Federation. And of course, the Civil War was a two of the regional cultures actually attempting to leave with great bloodshed, and others in between. So yeah, it's been divisive from early on. I mean, there are things that held us together conceptually, but they're relatively weak forces when you start seeing the things that kept us separate. And that's created divides through our history and also have created, you know, and you can see their imprint in things like the compromises made and the way the Constitution is written and other issues.
When we speak of fundamental American values, aren't we talking about the Enlightenment values of the founders, like, you know, Locke and Hobbes and Rousseau, you know, government deriving its right from the governed. There's natural law, the rights of liberty and property. Aren't those some core values that we all seemed to agree on?
Sort of. I mean, the ideas of Locke and those other Enlightenment thinkers, in a way, the after the American Revolution, we were seeing an applied experiment in that, and that is an unusual thing in world history and something that that America is rightly seen as having been a pioneer in. But underneath those ideas that we were going to try to be a self-governing republic were very different interpretations about what that all really meant in practice. Yeah. You know, for instance, in the New England colonies, remember the early Puritan experiment was essentially a group of people who believed themselves to be in an old world style covenant with God, and were going to create a more perfect society on earth, you know, the light on the hill, and they were going to do it through shared public institutions. And the idea of what you were pursuing was a better community idea. And if the individual and individual greed and aspirations were getting in the way, this is a very Calvinist idea, that the individual needed to stand down, right? That ultimately, if the common good and individual freedom are in conflict, it's the common good community values that matter. Go to another region of the country, and that is entirely does not compute. Say the area I call Greater Appalachia. First, the sort of settlement hearth was in south-central Pennsylvania. It was a huge migration of people from the war-torn borderlands of the British Isles, from Ulster and the Scottish lowlands and the English marches. Many of them were Scots-Irish. Mm-hmm. And this is an area where there had been great insecurity, constant warfare, and very few institutions surviving on the ground, where government was, if it arrived at all, was usually in the form of, you know, a bunch of people with lances trying to mow down your family. You needed to protect your kith and kin yourself, right? And it's about individual responsibility, personal sovereignty, and individual freedom in a tyrannical world with few institutions. And they came to the frontier because, in part because they were more comfortable on the frontier than a lot of other ethnic groups. And they brought with them this idea of personal sovereignty, individual freedom, that freedom means maximizing the lack of restraints on individuals to be able to do these things. Totally the opposite in practice of the New England concept. Mm. So, you know, play those out in almost any public policy circumstance, yeah, and you're going to see enormous conflict and friction, even as both are pursuing an idea of freedom and self-government. One is pursuing self-government through the town meeting and shared institutions with the idea of the whole community's benefit moving forward. The other is self-government emphasizing the individual, and that creates all kinds of friction, just in the examples of those two regional cultures.
We're going to break down as many of these cultures as we can, these different nations, as we go. But let me ask you, generally speaking, is this experience of one country, you know, bleeding into 11 different nations, is that different from the experience of other countries? Other countries have, of course, diverse histories of different people coming in and going. And I mean, is there one Germany, one Denmark, one Japan that's different from the concept of the United States?
Yeah, far more so. We're not unique, but because we're, you know, became one of the most powerful countries, and for certainly in time periods the most powerful country in the world, yeah, the relevance of our experience to world events is much larger than it is for, say, Canada, which has a similar pattern, or even Mexico, which is a federation of very different regional cultures. But many other places, including many of our peer Western democracies, are essentially nation states, mm-hmm, right? There are differences between northern and southern Germany or northern and southern Italy and France and stuff. But by and large, there is a majority French and German culture with general consensus on the big questions, certainly Japan as well or Korea. Or it's a much more simple situation with a federation of, say, two entities, you know, the Dutch and the Walloons in Belgium, which makes it much, much easier. Or you have an imperial situation where there is one dominant metropolitan culture that rules over the others, as in Russia or the Soviet Union, with many other, you know, minority, you know, captured nations, but where one is definitely in charge and ruling the roost. In our situation, what I think makes it most complicated and unique and unusual beyond the relative power of the United States is the fact that we're a pretty amnesiatic people, yeah, and the fact that we don't actually understand our regional splits and what divides us makes us rather unique. You know, that through the not realizing what is going on and what's shaped our history, it's made us a rather unusual actor and caused a sort of lot of confusion both in our own history and in how other people look at our country and the disputes we get into.
So what are the implications for that, that we are a country that is just determined to be and always will be divided in some way, and we have to either figure it out or what? I mean, what is the conclusion you come to based on that, all of that?
Well, I mean, we were brought together by, like you say, this experiment in self-government, by the idea of maximizing human freedom as a great experiment. I mean, that was a pretty unusual that you'd have an applied experiment like that take place. Yeah. And we've done it, and we've achieved remarkable things for the world and for ourselves during that experiment. But underneath it, unexamined, was the fact that freedom was never clearly defined, and different regional cultures had very different ideas of what it meant. And, you know, when you, like I said, with the example of, say, the Greater New England space or Yankeedom and the Greater Appalachian one, the idea of whether freedom is really about maximizing individual freedom or maximizing the common good or the freedom of the community, mm-hmm, those things are at odds, and that's meant that we've been continuously conflicted. I mean, we fought a civil war, but you're seeing in the discussions of the polarized nation and red states and blue, behind that are these very issues that that I'm speaking of that are so divisive and mean that we lack consensus. We've always probably lacked consensus, but it wasn't quite so obvious to us at different phases in our history.
It seems like we've divided up the regions of the country into these vastly oversimplistic sections. We've got the Midwest, and you have the South, and you have the North. I mean, these are the regions that we talk about during election years, for example. But that's not accurate at all. And when you look at, and we'll put this up on our website, when you look at the map of the 11 nations, which bleed into Mexico, bleed into Canada, for example, there's the far west, which is massive. There's First Nation up north. It's interesting. They don't really fit into those regions that we conventionally had in our minds. And you write this in your book. You say those older regional jurisdictions are illusions that you say mask the real forces that have always driven the affairs of our continent. Say something about that, that we're masking something about ourselves.
Correct, because the way that the patterns of settlement across the continent did not follow state boundaries.
Right.
And all of the ways that we look at regionalism and the ways that polls and other things analyze things by region are following state boundaries that are irrelevant. You know, there are many states that are cleaved between different regions. And the people of those states, when you stop and think about it, know that that's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the discussion between upstate and downstate Illinois, or the relationship between the parts of central and northern California, of Washington State, Oregon, and indeed British Columbia that are on the Pacific side of the coastal mountain ranges, mm-hmm. and the parts that are in the interior.
Yeah.
All of those states and provinces, coastal zones, agree with each other politically and in all sorts of different key issues and entirely disagree with the interiors of their own states and provinces. The same with Texas. I mean, Texans know that Houston and San Antonio and Dallas are the hubs of three very different Texases with entirely different values. So, you know, Maryland, you could go Ohio, Pennsylvania, they all have distinct cleavages. And the reason is that they were settled by different streams of people. And
right.
once you see that, once you zoom down to the county level and follow the regional fissures, everything makes a great deal more sense. And also your data at whatever issue you're looking at is clarified a great deal. Indeed, why some states are swing states becomes much more clear based on their settlement patterns and you know, the fissures that you see from the way that a state like Ohio was settled in the early 19th century between an area that was contested by Connecticut and became the Western Reserve of Ohio up on the shores of the lake with Cleveland and stuff, that was settled entirely by people from Connecticut because they were granted land title. And southern parts of the state were settled via Virginia, really via Kentucky, because for very different political reasons. And once you see that, you start seeing it correspond to actual county level election results in any closely contested election in our history right up to the present. So that it's the masking by looking at state boundaries as being meaningful that hides this more divisions than it actually shows.
And this is a really important point that you make in the book, because a lot of people are going to say, well, right, okay, of course there were these original cultures, but those cultural ideas fade away over time. It turns out it doesn't quite work that way. In fact, you say what happens is that the people who move into certain areas assimilate into the culture around them, not the other way around. I guess that's why those cultures stick around.
Yeah, or at least maybe they personally don't, but their children and certainly their grandchildren tend to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the same thing that happens in human societies worldwide. You know, if you or I moved to Germany or France, we might still be Americans and never quite feel German or French. But if we stuck around and had a family, our children and certainly our grandchildren would probably speak those languages and consider themselves to be of that nation. And the same thing happens here. It's just people don't come here and assimilate, become American. They're actually becoming assimilated to one of these regional cultures over time. But the other factor, you know, you would think that these things would fade away. Another factor is as people move around mm-hmm. within the continent, Social scientists have been discovering for some time as they look at who moves and their characteristics that the people who move, statistically speaking, tend to resemble more the places they're going to than the places they came from, including under various political values.
Yeah.
And that has enormous implications. In other words, people are self-sorting to be among like-minded people. To the extent that you can control where you move next, people are choosing to move to places where they feel they belong and they're among like-minded people. And that's caused a sorting that's reinforcing the differences between these nations, even as we have the internet and mass retailing and mass communications that you would think would be breaking them down. Consider this. There's this book that came out about a decade ago by Bill Bishop and Robert Cushing called The Big Sort that was looking at some of these issues.
We had him on the show.
He
talked about this.
Yeah. Oh, very good. Yeah. And you know, he found that they were looking at statistics on landslide election counties that always voted 20% or more for the same party over and over again. And the amazing – the question they had was, well, in 1976, like less than 27% of the 3,100 counties in the country were landslide counties. Right. And by the time they were writing the book in 2004, it had jumped to almost 50%. I mean, essentially a doubling. And they were like, what happened? And what I just described is what was essentially happening. People were sorting themselves. So, yeah, you would think that these regional distinctions were going away, but in fact, our mobility is strangely reinforcing them.
So if you go around the country, the Applebee's or the Best Buy in Portland, Oregon, seems like the same one in Jackson, Florida, or Kittery, Maine. And the people in those places can gather together online for Warcraft chat groups or vintage car collecting, you know, chat groups online. I mean, we're not isolated anymore. So you would think that these cultural distinctions would be breaking down and blurring in light of all of that. But you say in the book that the fault lines between these different nations seems to be growing wider and wider. Is it because of that sorting that we're doing?
Yeah, in part it's the sorting. Immigration, when it occurred from the great waves, the late 19th century on into the 20th century, the immigration did not come evenly. You know, people tended to concentrate in certain regional cultures and avoid others entirely. I mean, you look at the 1900 census by county and they ask people, are you foreign born or not?
Mm-hmm.
And the results of the percentage of people who said that, which is kind of a cipher for where did the immigrants of the great late 19th century waves go to, they published a map showing the density. And essentially, nobody came to the Deep South, Greater Appalachia, and the Chesapeake area. They avoided it entirely. And all of it is concentrated in other regions, in the Greater New England one and in two multicultural, you know, many cultures living side by side cultures, one founded by the Dutch, one by the Quakers. And that has enormous implications too, because it's reinforcing ethnographic trends and values at the same time. So there are several things at play, but ultimately, you know, by any empirical measurement, the differences are growing. You can see it in political behavior. You can see it in polls of people's values. So the question is why rather than, you know, is it true or not? And trying to figure out exactly why those things are growing is one of the most interesting sort of subfields of American nation studies, if you will.
Colin Woodard is with us. His book is called American Nations. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, an explanation for why this country is so divided. The historian and journalist Colin Woodard says we've always been divided, and here's why. It's because we're not just one country. In fact, we're 11 distinct regional nations, all with different cultures and ideas for how the world works. Woodard is joining us today as this book where he breaks down these 11 nations. There's Yankeedom, there's the Midlands, the Left Coast. We're in the Far West, by the way. The book is called American Nations. All right, let's start breaking some of these down. I hope people will put a map of these regions and they can get it on our website in front of them as we go through these. Let's start with Yankeedom. Yankeedom begins with the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And these were radical Calvinists. They have in mind for the way the world is supposed to work, kind of a religious utopia. And they're the ones, you say in the book, that have the greatest faith in the potential of government to improve people's lives. Talk about Yankeedom.
Right. From those early days, the building of the more perfect society that the Puritans were trying to do was done through public institutions. I mean, they would go to the frontier, and in that greater New England zone, it wasn't somebody in their coonskin cap, you know, building a log cabin in the middle of nowhere. It was a community arriving, usually, under their led by a cleric, and setting up immediately dividing up the land into house lots in an organized way around a common pasture, and taxing themselves to immediately build a meeting house and a public school. So, I mean, it's a very community-minded venture, and very communitarian in its focus, but it always had this mission, you know, that you are going. It is possible to improve and make a better world here now, a utopian vision, and we should do that. Yeah. And that Yankee New England spirit, the light on the hill, and that we will do that and improve the world, was part of the impetus for New Englanders as they spread across the country. They spread across a sort of northern tier across upstate New York, the Western Reserve of Ohio, and into the upper Great Lakes states, and even had a concerted effort, including literally missionaries who were trying to save these regions of the country from the other competing cultures. You know, we must save the Midwest from the terrible Kentuckians, mm-hmm. right, and make it safe for the New England way. The same thing they tried to do on the Pacific coast, the area called the Left Coast, where they, you know, were coming by ship and trying to create what they called a Massachusetts on the Pacific, a new light on the hill, and to sort of create and further their perfect society. They lost control, though, in the early Republic of the sort of destiny of the country, and that was greatly troubling to the New England effort. But that was their plan and their hope. They had a particular mission in mind, and the building of a more perfect society through public institutions. And that means that, you know, to this day, it's also the region that is most comfortable with the idea that, you know, good can come out of government, that right. the government is us and we will use it to improve society, which is, you know, rubs against and rubs the wrong way other regions of the country with very different backgrounds.
I don't want to oversimplify this by identifying each region with a political party, but my guess is Yankeedom tends to vote Democrat.
Well, today it does, but the Republican Party was born in Yankeedom and was almost explicitly the party of Yankeedom for the first century of its existence, at a time when it was about, you know, sort of fiscal prudence and building, you know, building the country out through those common efforts. You know, the more individualistic-minded party where property rights, be it in slaves or what else, was the most preeminent idea, was the idea of the Democrats during the middle decades of the 20th century. Now, as the parties flipped in many ways their values, their platform, and their constituencies, yes, the Yankee Zone has become a strongly Democratic region recently. And, you know, but if you look at the map, if you look at a county map of the red counties, blue counties in 1916 when Woodrow Wilson was taking on Charles Hughes, and you compare it to a 2008 or 2012 map of, you know, President Obama, you know, Obama versus McCain or Obama versus Mitt Romney, you'll see the same map essentially with all the colors swapped.
Right.
So the fissures remain the same even as the party has changed.
Yeah. Well, of course, it would have to be that New York City had its own nation pretty much. This is New Netherland. Talk about this. This is, of course, the culture that gives us New York City. It's multi-ethnic. It's multi-religious. It's speculative, free trading. It's raucous. You write this, that New Netherland nurtured these two really important Dutch innovations. One, a tolerance for diversity, and another, a commitment to this freedom of inquiry. Talk about this section, even though it's shrinking. Talk about New Netherland.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the area around New York City, the sort of Big Apple zone now, and it was founded by the Netherlands when the Netherlands was the most sophisticated society in the Western world, in the golden age of Amsterdam, when Amsterdam was a center of world trade and foreign currency transactions and the first globalized trading corporations in the form of the Dutch East India Company, and was also a refuge for people persecuted by the other kingdoms of Europe. I mean, many of the great Enlightenment thinkers had to go to Amsterdam because their lives were in danger and published their books and their works in Amsterdam. Yeah. It was a commercial and publishing powerhouse and business powerhouse. Then they created this colony, this little village on the end of Manhattan Island that from the very beginning when it had 800 people was very much like Amsterdam itself. The Dutch were never themselves in a majority. They were people of all different faiths and ethnicities living in this little city-state that was always connected to world markets, that was plugged in as a commercial global trading city even before it was a city. And that's why New York and the Big Apple Zone remain a place apart from the rest of the continent and always have been. It's that multi-ethnic approach and that idea of being plugged into the whole world as a trading peoples and sort of a Hanseatic style city-state.
Say something about the Midlands. This is what you call the most American, in quotes, of the nations. It was founded by the Quakers, I guess also a utopian idea that gets it started.
Absolutely. A bit different from the utopian ideas of the early Puritans, because the Quakers, you know, the Puritans felt that, you know, mankind was corrupted and that individual people would run amok if you didn't keep track of them, whereas the Quakers believed in the inner light, you know, the essential goodness of people. And one of the policy implications of that William Penn's colonies in Delaware Bay adopted was a pretty open door to immigration. People could come to the Quaker colonies without passing a strict religious test, without speaking a particular language. It had an open door for the Scots-Irish to come in and end up in the backcountry and found the greater Appalachian nation, but also to all sorts of people from the German principalities. You had Amish people and Mennonites and people from all over the world coming into Philadelphia and spreading out through the frontier. And no ethnic group, just like in New Netherland, was in charge. It was fine. You were supposed to come and build your own farming town or your own neighborhood side by side with others and retain your cultural characteristics. Keep speaking your dialect of German. Publish a newspaper in it. Have your schools in that. You know, and that was all fine. It's the vision of America as a mosaic of different peoples living side by side. And it spread in a narrow settlement band out through Pennsylvania and the middle tiers of the lower Midwestern states and then out in a big fan into what we consider the heartland, right, encompassing almost all of Iowa and spreading out into parts of other states. And it has that – it's very American and it's sort of the compromise position. It's the great swing region because it shares with greater New England the idea that society should be organized around, you know, sort of what we call the middle class today and around the good of the community. But at the same time, it rejects top-down government solutions and is very suspicious of them, both because the early Quakers were persecuted by the governments of England and elsewhere, but so were many of the initial settlers fleeing to the Quaker offer to come to their colonies from places in Germany and Central Europe and elsewhere that were highly tyrannical and where government was never a source of good. So it has a decider and kingmaker in many of our elections. And not coincidentally, the Midland Zone includes slices of some of our key swing states, right, like Ohio and Pennsylvania.
It's a moderating force in politics, you say, between you. So you've got these kind of extremes in some ways on either side, and it seems to cool tempers a bit in the middle there.
Correct. And if you were to take, you know, sort of the positions of all of these different nations and try to pick one that was closest to the middle, it would probably be the Midlands.
Right. Greater Appalachia is really fascinating. I guess this is the section of the country that's seen in caricature, right? These are the rednecks and the hillbillies and the white trash. But there is something to this idea of clans. They were clannish. You say in the British Isles, this particular culture seemed to be always in some state of war.
Or in a war zone.
Right, war zone.
Culture,
right,
formed within a war zone, yeah, absolutely. And you had extended cousinages where lateral family relationships were maintained and understood. It wasn't this sort of nuclear, you know, middle-class English view, you know, where you might know your grandparents, but maybe you don't know your second cousins. You know, it was a much more broad in that sense. And also from an area where institutions were not under local control and were thin on the ground. And so that was never a major priority. And also a culture of herdsmen, not farmers by and large.
Right.
And that also had implications for the way people moved around and used the land, but also with all of your property and valuables tied up in something that can be stolen very easily, it also created a premium on, you know, protecting your property yourself. And that sort of, you know, individualism, you know, almost libertarian ethic was very deep into the culture.
You say this is the section that gave us bluegrass music and country music and stock car racing and evangelical fundamentalism. Draw the distinction between Greater Appalachia and the Deep South, because there are important distinctions, and it seems like people think, well, you know, when you think of NASCAR or you think of country music, you think of the South as well, but there's an important difference here, I suppose.
Yeah, enormous differences. I mean, among them, you know, the Greater Appalachia was on the Union side in the Civil War, for one thing.
Big one,
but
the
lowland South, the deep South, separate from the Chesapeake country, was founded early on, the 1660s, by English planters from Barbados. And they were taking with them and planting around Charleston initially in South Carolina a fully formed Caribbean-style West Indies slave plantation society with all of the brutality and concentration of wealth that entails. And that society had been formed and perfected on Barbados in previous generations. And it extended through the lowlands, passing down a oligarchic culture, which did not really share in these ideas about, you know, Locke and Enlightenment thinkers. They were modeled on the classical republicanism of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, right? The slave states of antiquity, where a small group of people have the privilege of practicing democracy, and subjugation, subservience, and indeed slavery is the natural lot of the many. That was the model within their own thinkers of the form of republicanism that they were championing in the Deep South, which put them on a collision course with many of the other nations and on a collision course with the people who started coming down the Great Wagon Road, down the uplands of the Blue Ridge Mountains and on into Appalachia into their colonies in the backcountry, the so-called backcountry settlers who were greater Appalachian, who were very much about individual freedom and rejecting the inherited privileges of people like these sort of aristocratic plantation lords. Mm. And that caused enormous tensions. It played out in the Civil War and indeed play out since in the politics of those regions. Those are not natural allies, which again is why Greater Appalachia and the Deep South were on opposite sides in the Civil War. You know, the Greater Appalachian settled parts of Tennessee and the uplands of Alabama and Virginia all were on the Union side and rebelled. In Virginia, they succeeded and formed a separate Union state, West Virginia, in order to stay in the Union. In Tennessee, they had to be put down by force of Confederate arms. So it was only with Reconstruction when a sort of victorious Yankee-dominated federal army came to the region and with a mission of remaking it in the Yankee model, that it ran up against Greater Appalachian independence and made Greater Appalachia part of, I guess, what we call Dixie. Mm. But that's a phenomenon of Reconstruction, not the Civil War.
When we get back from a break, I want to talk about the Far West for obvious reasons. Talk about the Mormon experience and all of that. Colin Woodard is with us. His book is American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist and historian Colin Woodard. We're talking about his book, American Nations, where he breaks down the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. The Far West, this is the last region of North America to be colonized. And you say it's for one really important reason, and it's kind of the defining reason for the Far West. The fact is it's remarkably inhospitable. That's kind of the characteristic of this place. Explain that.
Right, especially in the context of technology in the middle and late 19th century when it was being colonized. You know, there was lack of – you needed big irrigation systems in order to farm, which stopped the traditional folk ways of the other nations in their tracks. You couldn't grow wheat or corn or cotton or any of the things that your society was sort of built around without having massive irrigation works. The distances to market and within the region were enormous and where it could not be easily spanned to connect you with the economy and to get supplies in and out. It was very high and the climate was extremely difficult and inhospitable. And the Native American tribes were still strong and able to work to repel people from invading their lands and territories fairly effectively. So it was a very difficult place to settle for all of these reasons. And by and large, especially outside the Mormon settlement area, it could only really be settled with industrial scale capital being expended to build infrastructure before settlement.
Right.
You know, in other areas, you would have two cities grow up and eventually there'd be the demand to build a railway between them. In the far west, the railways got the concessions and built the railways first and then encouraged the creation of sort of company-fostered towns around them to sort of create demand because before the railways were there, you couldn't have a town. So it was a very different approach. You know, the federal government or private sector bringing in the ore smelters, the massive irrigation systems, the railways and like that made life possible in the region. So it had a very different set of characteristics. And as I say, in American Nations is the one area of the continent where environmental considerations really did trump the ethnographic ones elsewhere.
Yeah.
So the ethnic patterns we describe don't really apply in much of the far west, again, with the possible exception of the Mormon settled areas, which we can talk about.
Yeah. We'll come back to that.
But the other areas were quite a bit, were governed by where external actors decided to place things and external actors who were going to treat the far west as an internal resource colony for the benefit of the, more seaboard nations,
yeah,
which caused tensions and resentments ever since. It was going to be exploited and was.
I guess that's a really important point, is that because the Far West is defined by the demands of these external institutions, the result is that we're a people who are deeply resentful of the fact that we're dependent. And that sense of resentment seems to be a defining characteristic of the Far West.
Absolutely, and always has been.
I mean,
back in the days of the Hearsts and the Anaconda Copper and the federal government, there were absolutely reasons for people to be upset. You know, the railways intentionally set freight tariffs in a discriminatory way so that you couldn't affordably move manufactured goods out of the region, only into it. So that meant that you couldn't have higher level value chain stuff happening in industry. They wanted to keep it a source of raw materials and not allow it to develop. And there was nothing anybody else could do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so all kinds of decisions like that made the region actually exploited and dependent on the federal government or these external corporations based in places like San Francisco and New York and Chicago, and had very real reasons to have grievances. Now, the grievances shifted around because sometimes the principal, a tormentor of the region appeared to be corporate in nature, which is why you had some of the great progressive senators were from the far west in the early post-war period, like Church and others.
Mm-hmm.
And other times, the greatest tormentors appeared to be the federal government, which, as you all know, controls a majority, sometimes an overwhelming majority of the land in many of these far western states.
Well, each legislative session of the Utah legislative session just finished the 2017, and there's always a resolution or always some piece of legislation dealing with that sense of resentment over the lack of control of public land. It comes up all the time. Let's talk about the Mormon experience, because you say the Mormons kind of created their separate nation in the far west. And it's interesting to see how Mormonism actually, of course, begins on the Yankee frontier but ends up in the far west. Talk about the uniqueness of that experience.
Yeah, I mean, if I were ever to reconsider the paradigm to try to get a more even and satisfying 12 nations instead of 11,
yeah,
the real candidate is there really a Mormon nation within the far west? And you could make an argument that there is, in that all those things I described about the other areas of the far west being settled dependent on external, industrial capital of one sort or another, that was not true in the Mormon zone, because
right,
when the Mormon migration happened, you know, fleeing persecution in the Yankee and Midland zones and coming to Utah to build a new society, they were able to work, you know, in that sort of communitarian fashion to collectively build the irrigation systems they needed and maintain them. Right. They were actually able to pool capital and do those things that other more atomized settlers weren't able to do, and to actually build and start creating a life in the, along the Wasatch Front that that was not dependent on external forces. In fact, the whole point was to be able to have control over over your affairs and development. So that meant that that zone had a somewhat different history than the others. It also, as you mentioned, the settlement drive essentially came from the greater New England space, from Yankeedom, and many of the people then and now who settled in Utah have, descended from people within the Yankee zone and often from New Englanders. And the religion, you know, there were these great awakenings that happened in the 18th century and early 19th century in the United States. Religiously speaking, they played out very differently on different frontiers. You know, in the greater Appalachian frontier, you had these big revival meetings and the emergence of, you know, more individualistic religions where the emphasis was on personal salvation and that individuals could have their own sort of unmediated direct relationships with the Creator, and that you didn't need to have a religious, you know, bureaucracy and liturgy and learned pastors. That was not the case on the Yankee frontier. On the Yankee frontier, a lot of the religions that emerged during that time period were, like the Puritans, yeah, had a utopian streak where the idea was that you could build a better and more perfect society and ought to try to do it. And that there's parallels between what the Mormons were trying to accomplish when they came to Utah and what many of the Puritans were trying to do when they were coming and first settling the New England colonies. The idea that you could and should together build a more perfect society here on Earth now. So that has a very different tradition than a lot of the rest of the Far West that was settled by a scattering of people from all different regional cultures who didn't have together a sort of cohesive culture that was brought like a, you know, like a seed and planted in the soil, but rather a culture conditioned by the experience of being exploited from the outside world with people from all over the place.
But you've covered Utah. You've come here and looked at the culture. Do you think that that sense of communitarianism that was part of Mormon culture has faded away? There's some argument. It seems to me you see a lot of, most of the lawmakers who were griping about there being too much public land or the federal government imposing its will on the states, these were mostly, have been, Mormons. So is there much of a distinction anymore between, it seems like Mormons now, while they may have been at some point their own separate nation, are pretty well part of the Far West now.
Yeah, well, that's why I ultimately ended up categorizing it, you know, not separating it out into a 12th nation. Yeah. And you all, of course, know much better than I do. I've been out on one reporting trip a few months ago to Utah, so I don't know it well. But I will say that in comparison with other parts of the continent in the Far West, it still is different. And remember, you know, the Mormons' relationship with the federal government was always extremely fraught. Yeah. So that should not be a surprising element by any means. Right. However, at the root, I mean, I was writing about Envision Utah, a big magazine piece for Politico, you know, over the sort of 25-year history of it. And here is a place where, you know, ultimately and often explicitly, the communitarian heritage of the early Mormon settlers was evoked as Envision Utah was being unveiled in your big press conferences, mm-hmm, where they actually had an actor dressed up as Brigham Young, you know, talking about the collective efforts to together build and plan a society that would work. You know, that was built in, and I think part of the success ultimately of something like a big, you know, land use project in order to protect the values that Utahns share. That would not necessarily be as possible, I think, in the Far West outside of the Mormon settled area, because you're drawing on a lot of these characteristics that are latent there that people do respond to. So I think there's something to it. I have no basis of comparing it to the past because I just don't have any direct experience. But I would say that it's still remains noticeably different in certain regards in other parts of the Far West, I can say as an outsider visiting different parts of the Far West.
We don't have really much time to talk about how all of this works for the 2016 presidential election. You've written about this, and we'll put a link to that on our website, where you go in and you break down how the various nations voted. You talk about Trump as a figure, that he was the most communitarian-sounding Republican nominee since Nixon. And that's really interesting. So there are some distinctions there, and how he appealed to the various nations, I think, are interesting. Let me ask you finally, though, what does all of this mean, do you think, for the future now? In the book, you say a time might come when the only issue on which the nations find common ground is the need to free themselves from one another's veto power. So this question of secession, I know we kind of joke about, and I'm not sure there's any realistic expectation that that may or may not happen, but what do you expect? Will we stay divided? Will we find some common ground? What are you thinking about? This says about the future.
Right. I was writing 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, now these issues and tensions are much, much greater than at the time I first wrote those words. I hope that that does not happen, as somebody who is, a historian of the Balkans as well, and I spent most of my 20s in Eastern Europe and the Balkans covering the collapse of communism and the ethno-nationalist tensions and disasters that happened thereafter. Mm-hmm. I'm not one who thinks that that dividing up a federation is a safe or desirable thing to do, especially a superpower in the world that has so much influence on the sort of future and often the stability of world affairs. So I don't want it to happen. Could it? I mean, yes, it absolutely could, which is why we really need to concentrate on, solving some of these polarizing issues and finding some common ground. Now, I don't think that you can ever find a common position that all of the regional cultures will embrace. But what's happened through our history, when we've had periods where there's been a sort of dominant omnibus, consensus that's managed to take the country in a certain direction for decades at a time, it's been because you've had a regional alliance around a set of values or sort of a platform that gives you a supermajority of the regions. And that's what we need to move towards today, something that you can get enough people and electoral support to have a majority in the House and a filibuster-proof Senate majority in the Electoral College. And that in the past, that was not one party, because the parties weren't ideologically sorted. It was regional coalitions with, one branch of one party, another branch of another, that in effect formed a political bloc. Moving towards that, obviously, it seems clear to me, is going to require a shift into a somewhat more communitarian stance than where the 50-yard line's been in American politics lately. And that's something that Donald Trump on the campaign trail used to his advantage. I don't know that he's governing in that spirit, but on the campaign trail, he definitely did so. And there's, a lot of people have been, left behind and not had people from either party representing them for a long time. And we're seeing the sort of rebellion and pushback from that happening now. So the previous consensus is obviously not tenable. So we need to reorganize our politics around something that gives you more balance and a broader coalition.
That's Colin Woodard. His book is American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures in North America. He joined us from a studio in Portland, Maine. Colin Woodard, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on again.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed today by Adrian Moranville, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.